Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Chelsea from Greenlight, and we're excited to host tonight's event with Nelson George, presenting his new book, The Darkest Hearts. He'll be talking with Melissa Kimball, so you're in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Nelson and the team at Akashic for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. Though we're not able to host events in our store spaces, our community of authors and readers is still here. We're grateful for your support and for the chance to make space for conversation and connection. And importantly, tonight's featured book, The Darkest Hearts, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. We're excited to be able to offer actual shopping in our bookstore locations, 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday. And you can purchase Nelson's book and many others on site. Or order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. Our interviewer for this evening is Melissa Kimball. She is a connector, consultant, and Black cultural storyteller based in Chicago. She runs hashtag Black Creatives, a digital collective that she built from the ground up, where she shares her creative lessons. She's on a mission to showcase the stories of Black creatives so that Black creatives from all backgrounds can access what's possible. She's passionate about helping others learn from her experiences so they can find their own path and flourish. She'll be speaking with our featured author, Nelson George. He's an author, filmmaker, and lifelong resident of Brooklyn. His books include the first four novels in his D. Hunter mystery series, The Accidental Hunter, The Plot Against Hip Hop, The Lost Treasures of R&B, and To Funk and Die in L.A., all available from Akashic Books. Among his many nonfiction works are The Death of Rhythm and Blues, Hip Hop America, and The Hippest Trip in America, Soul Train and the Evolution of Culture and Style. As a filmmaker, he has directed the documentaries Brooklyn Boheme, Finding the Funk, and A Ballerina's Tale. He was also a writer-producer on the Netflix series The Get Down. His new book, The Darkest Hearts, follows former bodyguard Dee Hunter as he tries to put his past behind him. This fifth installment of Nelson's thrilling music-infused Dee Hunter mystery series reflects the challenges of being a Black business person in an era when the rules of entrepreneurship are constantly shifting beneath an increasingly polarized political environment. Nelson is going to be talking with Melissa, and then they'll be talking with all of you. Nelson and Melissa, please take it away.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here tonight with you, Nelson. Welcome. Thank you for letting us speak to you about your new novel.
Thank you, and thank you for coming in from Chicago.
Yeah, happy to be here. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah. So just want to go ahead and just get right into it. So one of the things I noticed about The Darkest Hearts immediately is that there's a lot of change and transitioning happening right around the story. So Dee Hunter moves from Brooklyn to LA. He's changing professions in a lot of different ways, going from security to talent management. There's also the theme of, you know, working with a new artist, a rapper who's does trap music. So that's also another change and transition in music in general, especially in this era. And then also dealing with like the new idea of what entrepreneurship looks like in this industry, especially as a Black person. how that's changing a lot as well. So I kind of wanted to ask you a little bit about that. Was that theme of transition and change, you know, was that intentional? And how do you think it's really informed, you know, this fifth novel in this series?
Well, definitely. I mean, also the book is set in the first year of the Trump presidency.
Ooh, so that's another really, really big drastic change.
In 2017. And okay. I felt like that was an important thing to capture because we were in an era of uncertainty and the sense of Trump and what that meant. Now, you know, we're a couple of years down the road, we know what that meant, but the roots of that were very clear in terms of, you know, some of the white supremacy language and the backlash against immigrants of all kinds, you know. So that's sort of over hovering over the story. And then moving to LA was something I felt like I've tried to take him. The first book we did, The Accidental Hunter, he was a bodyguard and he was a guy at the door waiting, you know, can you come in, can you not come in? And over the course, he's evolved and he's learned more and he's shown his own, as he's grown, both as a thinker and as a businessman, I wanted to give him a journey. So he's now, instead of being the guy at the front door, he's got an office on Sunset Boulevard, he's got a staff. And, you know, and it's also a journey that a lot of Black people in entertainment have taken. You know, I mean, the most obvious example is Suge Knight. Mm-hmm. Literally from bodyguard to mogul. He's not Suge Knight, D. Hunter is nothing like that. But the idea that you could go from the guy behind the stage, behind the scenes, into protector to the guy who's running a business, I thought that was a really good arc that represents the journey that was possible through, it's been possible to hip hop particularly, has been very, very great at creating these opportunities. But also he's someone who's from the old school world. His idea of Rakim is, you know, is a rapper, but business is business. So he's brought in to work with a kid from Atlanta, a little Day, who's on the come up. And I thought it was really very Atlanta that their first business meeting is at a strip club.
Absolutely.
You know, and that, and because one of the subtexts of the book as well is this idea of sexual exploitation. Mm-hmm. I think a story actually that informed this book. I think maybe 4 years ago around, I have a friend, a musician named Chloe Flower, who did the score. She worked with me on Ballerina's Tale. Mm-hmm. She's also very involved in human trafficking stuff. So she got me a meeting at the UN and I met with the two people who run their human trafficking mm-hmm. section. And what they told me is that I think the stereotype is that it's Russian girls from East who get sent to Europe. But human trafficking is happening that way. It's happening from Africa. If you go to Spain or Italy, you see tons of West African young women. Obviously, there's a whole thing happening in Asia. And one of the things that was interesting is that LA was one of the centers of human trafficking, which I did not know.
Wow.
So I thought that was an important thing to explore. And as a character that I've been working with, she's been in a couple of other books, but the much bigger part now named Serene Powers. And she's kind of a human trafficking vigilante, if you will. And that plot, I thought also that because of Trump and because of his own sexual allegations against them and so forth, that this idea of misogyny and all these things are part of the narrative as well. And the little Day has his own issues, and little Day has a guy next to him who, you know, made his money in the streets. But a lot of times these days, it's not like the drug game. A lot of it is human trafficking stuff happening in the hood.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to see how that's a sort of weaving around as ND has to make a decision, a couple of moral decisions in the book. And I thought that in the era of now where we're dealing with what it is to be American, what it is to be a moral person, you know?
Absolutely.
To give him a question, you know? And the question is, one of the guys who's gonna make Little Day a ton of money, gonna make him his own Diddy, he's gonna have his own beverage, but the guy's not just a Trump supporter, but he's involved in the privatizing of prisons. He's involved, his whole idea is that you market malt liquor and these things to create crime and to create bad behavior that feeds into the machine.
Right. Absolutely. The cycle. Yep.
Right. And so do you take the money? Do you not take the money? If you don't take the money, do you expose this guy? Or do you just go, okay, I'm not taking the money, but I'm not going to get. So I think that's a question we all have to ask ourselves at various times in this journey through America. Mm. Is it, what is it that we're willing to do to be in?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, to me, that, and so the Darkest Hearts is this idea of, you know, the title is inspired by the Heart of Darkness book by Conrad. And actually Kurtz, this is the name of the guy who runs a big corporation, is actually the same name as the character in the Heart of Darkness, Colonel Kurtz.
I love that attention to detail.
So I think that this idea of change leads you to questions. You know, every time we make a transition in our lives, it leads to decisions. And decisions are how you define character, ultimately.
I love that so much. And one of the things too that immediately jumped out to me was like the power of choice, right? And what I love in particular about stories that feature crime stories and thrillers that center Black characters is that oftentimes we don't get to see what goes into the decisions that they make in order to follow specific paths.
Right.
Especially in that arena. But I kind of want to go rewind a little bit and go back to the arc about Trump. Why do you think that was important to include within this novel?
You know, I got so mad. I remember the night that he won, and I was like, this is going to change everything.
Mm-hmm.
But don't be, but I knew that was, I knew we were going to have to, I put it this way, you know, we were always saying that under Obama, you know, there was a sense of calm. There was a Tea Party, and there were people, but we didn't really know how deeply his rise to power had frightened.
Mm-hmm.
The white folks.
Mm-hmm.
The bad white folks, the really racist, or even the people who didn't feel that, didn't think they were racist, but were uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been seeing Trump's victory, and all that's happened is basically a backlash. I mean, it's almost like Trump and those people can't walk two steps without getting Obama out their mouth.
Mm.
I mean, today there was a whole thing. I mean, they're trying to blame Obama for stuff. Like, there was a thing Trump said today, I think, something like, he spied on me in 2016. Now, let me tell you something. Barack and Michelle were not checking. They were not spying on him in 2016. They were checking their exit strategy.
Right. Right.
But that mentality, that's how deeply and profoundly Obama's presence just shook up these people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to deal with that sense of disquiet.
Ooh.
And it comes up a lot in the book. It's part of the plot, but it's also sort of a general sense of Dee goes through a lot of, and especially early in the book, he reflects a lot on Trump's role, you know, as we talked about off camera, that Trump was someone who was a fit that hip hop liked for a long time.
Absolutely.
That he was a symbol of capitalist success, which a lot of brothers who are, you know, aspired to that.
Mm-hmm. In the entertainment industry, for sure.
And so how that, one of my favorite things I said in the book is that Obama is the first Black president, and Trump is the first rap battle president.
Yeah.
Because when I thought back to those debates, those people are coming to debate. He's coming to diss.
Yeah, he's coming to just shut it down. Yeah.
And that was, I think that was really, I thought that was, then he was paying attention. When he was hanging out in New York in the 90s, he took the idea of that idea of the combative thing. And also he names, one of the things he did very effectively was name his opponents,
mm-hmm.
which is something that both MCs do, and it goes all the way back to Muhammad Ali even.
Mm-hmm.
If you name your opponent in a disparaging way, you somehow can take their power away because they spend all their time being angry about that and not focused on how to attack you. Because he's one thing that MCs are really good at is punching and encounter punching. And so I was like, wow, he is. And so the mainstream media, other politicians, they were trying to deal with him like he was a regular guy, but he wasn't really trying to play by their rules. So I thought about all that. I thought that's an interesting thread to deal with. And so when Little Day, who's my trap rapper, faces a moral decision, is he conscious enough to see the contradiction in this? Or does he see just empowerment? If I make this money, I'm helping Black people because I'm helping myself and other Black, my posse. And that's, you know, I think that's a question that comes up a lot with, you know, when we look at Kanye and some, you know. Yeah. So I think that these decisions are, you know, we don't even use the phrase selling out anymore. That was a big phrase back in the 60s and 70s. Artists would sell out. But I do think it's something to revive.
Absolutely.
You know, what is your moral responsibility? And Kanye's become, you know, obviously the test case for, we love his music, or we used to love his music.
Yeah.
And, you know, how much of this can we take from, and, you know, what's their responsibility to us?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. That's really great. Like I said, I definitely love the layers of the different issues and the references kind of all coming into one. And so that actually brought up a few things for me, sure. But I kind of want to go back to, we mentioned, well, in the intro earlier, Chelsea did mention that about your documentary, Finding the Funk.
Right.
So it's now, you know, available on Amazon, correct? Right. Yeah. Amazon Prime. And so that the fourth novel in this series was really connected to funk. So each, you know, novel in the series, for those who don't know, is also centered around a specific genre of Black music. So obviously you mentioned The Darkest Hearts definitely has that connection to trap music.
Yeah.
I'm also curious to know as to why trap music? Why the focus on that specific niche to build it into the story?
I feel like that's the latest and most powerful new genre of Black music to emerge. I mean, you know, it was crunk, and crunk had its run, right?
Mm-hmm.
But trap is an evolution out of that. And also because Atlanta has become the center of hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And trap has become sort of the byproduct of that. I felt like it was important. I mean, the first book dealt with a lot of different forms, the Axel Hunter, but the next, Plot Against Hip Hop, clearly that's what that was about. Mm-hmm. The Lost Treasures of R&B, funk. So I was at one point gonna have trap in the title,
mm-hmm.
but I felt like this, because of the Trump level and because of that layering, I felt like I didn't want it to seem like, okay, he's gonna just delve into trap music. This is more of a journey into morality.
Mm.
Right? And so I wanted to have a title that reflected the idea that you're going into this place. So, and that is larger than that. But I think the idea of Black music has so much mythology.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely want to explore jazz. I want to explore blues. I want to explore some other parts of it. Because that's the beauty of Black music, is that it's rich in mythology.
Absolutely.
There's the real life of the artist, and then there's the worlds their music created in our minds, and whether that is, you know, Stevie Wonder or Prince or Jay-Z or so forth. I'm a big fan of August Wilson,
mm-hmm.
the late great playwright. And he used the blues as the backdrop of almost all of his pieces. Sometimes the musicians they're literally blues musicians in the story. And I'm thinking, so how do I take what's going on around me and the music I love and it nurtured me, and how do I use it in a way that deals with the mythology of it in some respects? And then was the hardcore nitty gritty. As you may know, I was a black music editor at Billboard from, I kind of covered black music, from like 79, 80 when I was in college till I left Billboard in 89. And there's lots of stories that I never got to tell. Some of it was because, you know, people, I couldn't really tell those stories because of legal reasons.
Yeah.
And so some of the layering in a lot of the book are a lot of these bits and pieces of stuff that I saw or great stories. And I think that the mystery crime genre lends itself very well to this because black music that's nocturnal music, right?
Absolutely.
It's nightclubs, it's yep. backyards, it's studios, and there's always been, whether it's Frank Sinatra or anybody else, there's always a little gangster shit going on because it's late at night, there's cash money going on, there's drugs. And so I love that part of it. So I said, this is the perfect world. The world of music and the world of this, what I call the underworld and the music world often go hand in hand.
Yeah, no, I love that so much. And that's such an excellent point. That makes me think about, again, you know, I'm in Chicago having uncles and cousins being outside doing who knows what and, you know, blasting Marvin Gaye or,
yeah.
you know, like playing something really, really soulful. So I love that connection. And I love that, you know, too, through, you know, this series as well, like you can, that's also like a, to me, a soft way to really pay tribute to like the complexities of black music, right? And all that like it entails.
Oh yeah, I mean, I because I also started saying like, what do I know about? When I, you know, I looked at all of the detective novels I liked. A lot of them had specialties or they had threads that they were good at. And I feel like this is something that I knew very well, the world of music, and that I could tap into it. I mean, it actually goes to the trap thing because I felt like if you were a young manager and you're trying to figure out what's happening and you're just trying to make some money, you're looking at trap right now. Or you're looking at something to line the trap.
Yeah.
You know, and then what's the name of that quality control? Mm-hmm. You know, the people who manage Migos and several other, Migos are their biggest, but they also have Gucci Mane. I think they had a relationship with Gucci Mane at one point. So I read a little bit about them and about who they were, but they're kind of, to me, they were the closest institution, you know, of hip hop. Now I know they're having problems right now with the Migos, I just read. So
it's always something.
There's always something. But so I sort of looked at where, if I was gonna do trap, okay, who are the entities in trap that are, that are established and have little empire, and what is the culture of it? And then, you know, I'm way middle aged, so I didn't feel obligated to like love trap because it looks a little stupid if I'm out there talking about the Migos. I'm sorry, but I wanted to feel like that if you're involved in the music now and what is black music, you have to always be aware of what's going on with it and how it moves. I actually read a lot about 6'8".
You know, 6'9". Yes.
Right. Still amazing, see? And, you know, the fact is that he became a rapper, but it was gangs that helped him get large, and gangs also kind of pulled him down to a degree. So the idea that, you know, he was connected to the street in some form. And I use that Little Day is very much modeled, some Little Day's relationships are modeled after 6ix9ine and stuff that I read about. So, you know, trying to make sure that the stories, it's interesting, you can take every generation and go back.
Mm-hmm.
And the music's different, but some of the dynamics of money, some of the dynamics of whether or not they have a, when they say underworld tie, I mean like who in the hood has money, who helped them, that you can go all the way back to the blues and something like that's going on.
Yeah, I was just thinking that as you were saying that, like, it's amazing how even in 2020, like, that's still something that's that happens a lot in the music industry, especially with rappers, how, you know, even though, like, a lot has seemingly changed in our society, like, a lot hasn't really changed.
I mean, the fundamentals of, because how do people make money? I mean, that's always fascinated me, and that's one thread with the music, and is, you know, D. Hunter, my main character, is someone who's always made money off music in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And so making him a manager means that his whole relationship to the culture changes, because now he's supposed to be guiding people. He's supposed to be giving guidance. And think about it, he was just a bodyguard, you know, the first book came out, 2011 or something? So, you know, within 10 years, does he really know that much? No? So he's confronted with his own limitations as well during the book. And I think that that's important, that when people move up the ladder, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're ready to move up the ladder. Mm-hmm. And so I think some of the mistakes he makes in the book are predicated on his own inexperience. Because there's not a roadmap. There's not like a school.
Right. You know? This type of trajectory, not at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and no, I'm glad you brought it back to D. Hunter, because I wanted to also look at too, like, his growth throughout these five novels, like, in terms of, you know, where he was in the first novel up until now. And kind of wanted to get your insight on how you think he's grown as a character in these past five novels. And is there anything in this series that you think will surprise people about his growth without kind of giving the story away?
Well, I can say one thing, you know, and this is in the first book, it becomes key. I'll put it this way. When I first saw a thought of the character, a couple of things made me write him. I saw a picture of Britney Spears one time in a newspaper, and there was a huge black guy right behind her. Mm-hmm. So who's that guy? What does he see? What does he know? So I was really intrigued with that character, that guy. And then, you know, you go to clubs, there's always the brother at the door, mm-hmm. you know. And so I was looking, what is his life like? What secrets does he have? And then, so I thought about that. And then there was a case, this is a true story. I saw an article in the newspaper of a family in Brownsville. I'm from Brownsville, Brooklyn, which mm-hmm. is a neighborhood in Brooklyn, a tough black neighborhood that's been poor since the 50s. And it was a family from Brownsville that during the crack era, one son had been killed in 87, one son had been killed in 89, one son had been killed in 91 of this family, three sons. So I thought, okay, what if you were the surviving son? What would that do to you? So that was another thread. And the final thread is that my sister has been HIV positive since 1993. And I've seen her, so I wanted to take this big guy, this big imposing man, but there's a vulnerability. There's something that he's protecting inside of him. Mm-hmm. And so the HIV plays a big part in the stories of the first few books. But what's interesting is that my sister has been Andrea, has been my guide. And so she's been living with the virus now that long. And it's not that big a part of her life anymore, which is a strange thing to say. Between her T-cell count is good, the amount she takes, very few medications now. So as the books have progressed, it's still in there, but it's not as central to who he is.
Wow, okay.
He still has questions about it, but one of the things they come to is, but it always comes down to sex. At what point does he tell whoever he's about to get with mm-hmm. what's going on? Mm-hmm. So that still comes up, but it's not a life or death thing for him. Like it felt like a few books ago. So those are all the ways in which he's evolved for me. I used to make a big deal in the books that he always wore black all the time. Mm-hmm. Like it was a constant state of mourning.
Wow. Was that just because of the security position that he was in, or
one of his brothers.
Okay.
I mean, but he was able to play it off as that.
Okay.
But ultimately, in a sense, he was in mourning for his family. And I think that one of the things interesting about moving to LA is that he's away from his mother. He's away from Brooklyn, but he gets drawn back to Brooklyn by events that happened in the earlier books. So The Plot Against Hip Hop, which was the second book in the series, is a big influence on this one. You don't have to have read that book to get this book, but if you read that book, it will enrich your experience of this one.
Okay.
Because I think that, you know, Black people, we like conspiracy theories.
We do. We do. We do.
And you know, and the tricky thing about it is that there are some things that have happened to us that make us think that conspiracies are going on. But sometimes it's hard to figure out what's real and what's not. And so I wanted to play, in a sense, in a way, this book is about another conspiracy theory that they find, a conspiracy that they find that there's a, I don't want to give away too much of a story, but they find, Dee finds out some information about Kurtz, the big corporate guy who's offering the big alcohol deal to Little Day, and he's got to figure out what to do about that. And I think that, you know, because I mean, there are people.
That's my phone.
Sorry. You know, there was a guy who was one of the contributors, I think it was Al Schultz, I'm going to forget, who was one of the people who had money in Coachella. I don't know if he's still in Coachella, but he was a big Republican guy. He had a lot of, you know, he supported a lot of nasty stuff. And so I thought about, you know, I go to Coachella and there's all this liberal artist and Beyonce played there, blah, blah, blah. And what if they found out that they were working for somebody who was making a lot of money off them, who was basically working against their best interest? And that's the tricky thing about now, because when you look at, like, we all use Facebook. Mr. Zuckerberg is very questionable to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, are we willing to get on Facebook or not? These are kind of, you know, it seems funny, but we have a ton of, in this age where everything's so interconnected, we have a ton of more questions that we always have to be asking about. Who owns this? What's connected to that? You know, it's something that's come up a lot, obviously, this year. And I mean, Equinox is a gym I go to. And then I heard a little stuff about the guy who he was doing a big fundraiser for Trump. Sounds like right out of my book. So, you know, so much of what we call capitalism, corporate capitalism, those people are supporting this. They're about their money. They're about tax breaks. And they're certainly not thinking about the common good. And so that's a big part of it. To me, those are the darkest hearts.
Wow. That's a really big statement. But that's an important statement, but that's a really big statement for the book to make too. Especially as we're going into, you know, election season.
Yes. That's why I wanted to make sure why it was set in the year after Trump, because it's like, oh, wow, we're in this, aren't we? And we look, this ain't Bush.
Yeah, right.
This is next level stuff. And so throughout the whole book, there's these moments of awakening to how dangerous the waters are. And it's so interesting because now, obviously, we're in a different, because of not just Corona, but because of all the response to George Floyd. And so, like, we're in a different place that we couldn't even have conceived of.
Not at all.
In 2017.
Not at all. Not at all.
So, I mean, the book is already a period piece.
You know. When you started out writing the book, was that in your mind at that time? That
it would. The Trump administration changed the book.
Wow.
It definitely made it more political and more pointed. I think I wanted to do something. I definitely had the idea that the guy who ran Kurtz had a secret that would cause Dee and his clients to have a reckoning. But I think that the tie-in with Republican ideology, or I wouldn't even say Republican, I would say right-wing ideology,
mm-hmm.
and the idea that planting, you know, we always talk about malt liquor in the Black community and a bunch of liquor stores in the community. So it's not a big leap to go from, we have all these liquor stores, these liquor stores are not just there, they are part of a way to transfer and create people for our we can arrest more people if they're more fucked up on drugs or drunk or alcohol and put them in and become slaves for the system that is the incarceration industry.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big leap.
Not at all.
and we're seeing that we're seeing through what happened with Russia, we're seeing that there are some Machiavellian
mm-hmm.
people involved. And so this is all not as, the conspiracy theory that Black people have is not as crazy as sometimes we may think, or sometimes I think, I should say. And so I remember I showed the manuscript to some people early on, and they were like, oh, come on, man, you're going too far. And I said, I don't think so. I don't think that this is as big a leap as you think. And I think when you look at what's happened with, fill in the blank, Trump administration policy, and you can see how the government has been overrun by greedy bureaucrats who basically are corporate people who were using the government earlier outside, now they're using it inside.
Wow.
For a different mean. I mean, the woman who runs the Department of Education, you know, you can't get much more evil than that.
Right, not at all. Not at all. Wow. And so that's interesting too. I feel like in the context of, you know, a crime-based novel, because then it makes you think like, okay, so who's the real
criminal?
Right.
Yeah. Because I mean, there's levels. So there's Little Day, trap star, has his homeboy who's his bodyguard slash old school manager slash, you know, bag man, handle stuff for him, stuff, mm-hmm. is one level of activity, of mm-hmm. bad activity.
Mm-hmm.
He meets Kurtz, the corporate guy, and immediately they're like, oh, yeah.
Click.
The vision of the world is similar. And in the same way that when hip hop or when people in the Black community get so enamored of moguls mm-hmm. and money and capitalism, it can blind them to the darkness and the evil that can come out of that. Mm-hmm. And that the pursuit of money as its own end is not a satisfying spiritual destination, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. That's, and I definitely could see too how all of that services up in the book at the same time with these different types of themes. You know, the themes each change obviously for each book,
yeah.
and for each novel, but right. the character obviously in the story, the heart of that still stays the same. How do you find, as an author, as a writer, how do you find the balance between making sure that those themes kind of don't, you know, outweigh the full story?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's really hard to come up with these stories.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fun, but it's also challenging to come up with a big, because unless you're trying to totally subvert the genre,
mm-hmm.
you want to set up a world in which there's something in jeopardy. You want to set up the moral dilemmas for the character. They have to make decisions. And at some point, they have to come up with they have to either solve the problem
mm-hmm.
or come up with a solution that addresses it in some way. And that's what the people expect, to have that journey with the book.
Mm-hmm.
When you say it's a mystery or a noir. Mm-hmm. So you do have certain rules. Now, it doesn't mean that the ending is a happy ending or a satisfactory ending, you know, for like a happy, but it has to have some kind of resolution that addresses the initial query or question that you ask.
Mm-hmm.
And so doing that is it's definitely a challenge, and it doesn't usually come. I often make an outline. Mm-hmm. The outline is really, this should happen, this should happen, this should happen. Sometimes I don't know what the exact ending is. Sometimes I know what the ending should be, but I'm not figuring out how I can get there. So to some degree, it's mathematical. One thing I took from when I worked on the Get Down show, I'd never been in a TV writer's room. That was my first experience. And I really learned a lot.
By the way, just want to put that in there. I said, I hate that it left. Like, I was really mad about that. Well,
we have a plan.
Okay, good. Okay, great.
For a movie version of it. That would take us up to the 80s. That's probably 2023. But it's okay. Something, it's definitely something that we all want to do.
Okay, good.
But you know, one thing about I always wondered about TV, how they structured, because you know, how do they do that thing, you know? So being in the room and seeing how they worked both the story this way, you know, across the whole arc of the shows, and then how individual shows worked. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot from them, and I use a lot what I learned from that experience working in the TV room in the books, in terms of, I think I've gotten better at the plot now because mm-hmm. of that experience.
That's amazing. And I know we'll be switching to audience Q&A in about 5 more minutes. So just have one more question for you before we start that question. But, you know, one character across 5 novels, you know, is definitely a feat. What keeps you writing for Dee Hunter for a novel then?
Well, it's funny. At one point I was like, I don't know if I can, you know, what am I going to do with this guy? But then when I got the idea of him moving to LA, I liked that. And then him dealing with Trap, that was really interesting. And how would he deal with that coming from where he was coming from musically? Mm-hmm. And then once I got the idea of the endorsement deal and the deal with the devil that might be, that was really exciting.
Yeah.
So I had that beat, that I had that thing. And then I thought about Serene Powers. And she, again, she's a character who'd been in the previous novel. She had a pretty big part. But I really wanted to flesh her out as a character and give her more of a backstory, which she'd never had before. Mm-hmm. She's someone who might, I'm trying to figure out, she does her own standalone book.
I think she could too.
I have written a lot for her that's not in there. I'd written a whole lot about her that I felt like I was going to put in this book, but it felt like it would be too much to, I don't know. It felt like it would have taken that. That's a whole nother thread to deserve more time. But also there's a thing I introduce in this book. She meets this group in Europe, the Liberators. And mm-hmm. I have a whole world of the Liberators and this whole group of black art thieves.
Ooh, ooh.
Ooh. So maybe, you know, I think there's something there where Dee would be in the book.
Uh-huh.
But she would have her own plot. And mm-hmm. the thing is, I got to figure out, this is the tricky part, like, okay, I have this, this, and this, I have this, this, and this. How do these things come together? And I don't have that yet.
Okay. I mean, no, it sounds like you're off to a fantastic start, though.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think someone in one of the questions, Tracy, I think, a friend of mine asked a question about, okay, yeah, there's someone who asked, I just saw one of the questions from a friend about the differences between, you know, doing these different kinds of, because I've done documentaries and TV, and I've done a lot of nonfiction, obviously, and fiction. And I think that one thing that really came to me is that it's all storytelling.
Okay.
And a good story kind of tells itself. And then I think as you begin working through it, you figure out what is the medium by which you can tell it best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just had a meeting earlier today with a very a well-known musician who wants to do a movie and a book and a documentary about their life. And all of which this particular person has had a really big life. But the biggest challenge for him, I said, is like, okay, What is the story? What, you have a lot of stories. What is the story for this medium? For a movie, that's a different way of story than you tell if you're doing a docuseries, let's say, or a book. And so I think that is the biggest challenge. You know what is a good story. Mm-hmm. But how much of the story do you tell at a time? Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's really the biggest challenge is like I did a book on Soul Train. So Soul Train has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. You know, Don dies, Don Cornelius dies, that's the end, of course. And Don started it back in Chicago, actually.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the journey through that. So that's an easy thing to structure because there's a beginning, middle, and an end.
Right.
Things, but if you're going to do a story about, let's say, if you want to do a documentary in hip hop, okay, where do we start? Do we start there in the Bronx? Are we just doing now? Or so these decisions about where you start and where you end are everything in storytelling. Wow. If you don't know where you're going with your ending, then you can't, what do you got? Because you got to be driving the whether the viewer or the listener or the reader, you're driving them to a conclusion. Mm-hmm. And once you know the conclusion, one thing I learned is the ending is more important. Is the ending, I've written a bunch of books. I've changed the beginning of the book a million times once I figured out the ending. Because halfway through the book is when you really figure out what you're writing.
Wow.
And then you go, okay, that's the end, I'm going there. And you go, oh, that beginning doesn't at all have anything to do with at all. So I got to go back and rewrite the beginning. So I always tell anybody who's a storyteller, and that doesn't mean the movie, whatever they're doing, know the ending. Have an idea about where you're going.
Yeah.
Because you can't really build, you can build a structure around that idea, around that destination, mm-hmm. you know. But if you don't have an ending, you're just kind of writing. Eventually, you have to come up with, like, where am I going?
Absolutely. Is there a way to discuss what the destination is for the Darkest Hearts without giving it away?
No, I just say that I think that, for Dee, and actually for Serene as well, and some of the other characters, it's coming to terms with what I'm willing to do to stay in the game. Yeah. And that means, am I willing to get down and dirty and do stuff that, you know, not too nice? I mean, I'm talking about murder, but I'm talking about, like, you know, am I willing to blackmail someone? Am I willing to play a card that I don't, wouldn't want to normally play in order to survive myself. So in so doing, then you have to realize, who am I now that I've done this? Mm-hmm. Where is my own morality at in that? So I think that's a big part of it. I mean, I at one point I thought that maybe I had written out D and this would be the last piece, but I feel like there's more life to him and there's more life to the world he's in of Serene. And even there's a character called Ice who comes in and out of the book a lot, who's sort of he's sort of like the ghost of Brooklyn past, you know, who's haunting him a little bit. Mm-hmm. But one of the funny things is that everybody, at the end of the book, everyone has a story to tell. And like everyone's trying to figure out how to, because we're in a medium now, a moment where everyone between IG Live,
yeah.
streaming, you know, everyone's telling their stories. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're almost drowning in stories.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Nelson, for answering Tracy's question already about writing in different mediums and choosing which stories fit better in different mediums. I was wondering if both of you could sort of talk about what you're working on now, or in lieu of, or in addition to that, what you've been reading during lockdown and what other writers have been sustaining you during this time.
You want to go, Melissa?
Yeah, so I just finished reading The Vanishing Half by Brett Bennett. I really enjoyed, like, the movement of that story. Such a fun age. I just finished that one as well. I was a little concerned initially about both, to be honest, because I'm kind of over the whole, let's talk about white women's responsibility and racism and all that, and them trying to like atone for their sins. But what I loved about both of these stories is that it kind of took the focus off of not necessarily like just racism and moved it into like the story actually being owned by the people of color in both of these stories, and did it in a way that was very human, very authentic, and very like, I think very full too as well. So both of those books, like, I really enjoyed, and I read them pretty fast.
I've been reading a bunch of classic stuff. I just read Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, which I hadn't read in years, and whew, that is an amazing piece of writing and very relevant in terms of his ideas about Black autonomy, both in relation to the Communist Party, which was, is in there, but, and then about Black nationalism. A lot of, he wrote that book in 54, but a lot of the ideas and oppositional, the challenges to Black identity were there, and it's pretty raw in a lot of ways. And then I'm also reading this book here. This is The Big Money by John Dos Passos. It's part of a huge trilogy called the USA Trilogy. That's three books about the history of the United States in the first three decades of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty brutal critique of capitalism and the alienation that the pursuit of money alone can do. Very, very, very political book, but also very well, beautifully told, and kind of experimental in a lot of language and stuff. So I'm trying to, one thing I decided in lockdown mode is to stop looking at so much TV and streaming. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to read more bigger, since I have time, read bigger books. And I'm, you know, I'm finally gonna take on Dostoevsky and some of those people. Because I've never really read some of that great, you know, Europe, Russian literature that everyone talks about. I never read War and Peace or anything. So I think that, so I'm gonna try and take on some of the bigger books that maybe I have like, oh, I'm not ready for that. Well, I'm an old man, I should read them now.
Do you do any like reading, heavy reading while you're working on your novels?
I think reading stuff that inspires. And that might be, you know, there's a great book about Los Angeles, whose name is escaping me right now. But I mean, I read a lot of books about LA. I'll read books about other, you know, really good mysteries. Mm-hmm. It's always good to go back, and I read sometimes, you know, I'll read a Walter Mosley. We'll also go back to Chandler and some of that stuff. I mean, Chester Himes is still one of my favorite writers, and played a big role in me deciding to write this kind of fiction. Because I knew Cotton Clumps of Harlem was a movie, then I realized it was a book, and then I read Himes has about five or six of his Coffin Ed, Gravedigger Jones books. And they're not formally detective novels. They're crazy, surreal journeys through imaginary Harlem, basically, that he made up. He was living in Cleveland half the time. Mm-hmm. But he made up this Harlem that was quite amazing. So, and so he's very free. He doesn't give a damn. He's just going. So going back and reading the stuff that, especially summer, I find summertime's a good time to go back and read books that inspired me. And just, you know, because you have, it feels like you have more, the days are longer.
Yeah, absolutely. More sunlight.
Yeah, and there's some other, what nonfiction books have influenced, okay, I see one here about one. What nonfiction books have influenced my taste in music. Well, there's two books that I would cite is a seminal. Amiri Baraka, original name was Leroy Jones. He wrote a book called Blues People. I think it came out in 63. It's mostly about jazz and avant-garde jazz. It's a brilliant book about the relationship of Black culture to music. It's one of the first books that made me take writing about music seriously. And the other book is called Mystery Train by Greil Marcus. And that came out in the mid 70s. It's still, and that, it's essays about the mythology of American music. And there's two great chapters. There's one on Robert Johnson, the blues musician. That's the first time I ever heard of Robert Johnson at the time. I'd never really heard of him. And that book made me go back and go out and buy the records. And great, great introduction to Robert Johnson, the supposedly sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads. Mm-hmm. And then there's a great chapter on Sly.
Ooh, okay.
Great chapter on Sly. And that it was one of the first times I've seen anybody really write about Sly in a very substantial way as a very serious artist and his capturing his art. And there's other great essays in it, but those two chapters had a big impact on me as a young writer and, you know, made me want to pursue writing about music culture. So Leroy Jones, Blues People, and Mystery Train by Greil Marcus. I think those are, I saw one more book in there since we're doing it. Stompin' the Blues by Albert Murray, who was a friend of Ellison's. He was a peer of Ralph Ellison's. I think they grew up together. He was a big influence on Stanley Crouch and Wynton Marsalis. And this book, Stompin' the Blues, has this great idea. It talks about the Saturday night celebration and the Sunday morning ritual. Mm-hmm. And how Black culture, you have the Saturday night celebration and the Sunday morning ritual, and the same people might be at both.
Absolutely, yes.
I thought that was such a great insight into, and he's writing about blues music and jazz particularly. But again, these ideas that we use these phrases, jazz, blues, hip hop, trap, it's Black music, Black culture, and they're all intertwined. You can't really pull them apart from each other.
What is your process? When do you write? For how long? Do you prefer to write a certain amount of hours or at a certain time of day? An anonymous attendee asks if you could make an adjustment or two to your novel based on your experience and thoughts about these COVID times, what would it be? Another anonymous attendee also just asked, do you listen to music while you write?
Well, number one, the COVID thing deserves, that's a whole different book. I can't even get to that yet.
Yeah.
I have notebooks. I've always had notebooks around. I still keep them around. I find, you know, look at this stuff, this chicken scratch here, see? That ends up in these books, you know? So I think having a notebook or having a notepad or something around all the time, even if, you know, and it's random stuff. It's not like I write whole books. I'll write a word, a phrase or something that comes to me, and hopefully I think that at some point it'll come back and be useful. Like, I just wrote this down. This is how we keep score. I don't know what that means yet, but it's about something, right? It's about something about, this is how we keep score. So it could be a bunch of different things. So I think that writing is also, it's also a subliminal process. Often some of the best writing happens when you're washing dishes. Or working out or doing something that's got nothing to do with writing. And then what was the other, there was another part to it.
See, the last question was, do you listen to music while writing?
You know something? My favorite thing is having NBA games on. So I like having, I'll have an NBA game or action movie. There are things that I don't have to pay attention to, but I can look up and see something's going on when I get this, you know, so I can take a little mental break. Oh, they're about to shoot that guy now. Or, you know, LeBron just dunked on this guy. Oh, okay. And then I go back because it's kind of like white noise. Sometimes because I like music, sometimes music gets in the way for me because I'll listen to it. It's better to have something that's kind of like.
If you don't have to pay attention to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Nelson and Melissa, for this wonderful conversation tonight, for taking this time to speak with each other and to all of us. And thank you, everyone who virtually came out tonight and joined us for this conversation. A reminder that tonight's event has been recorded. If you had to miss any part of it, or you have friends or family who you know would enjoy it and had to miss it, it'll be posted on Greenlight Bookstore's YouTube channel. And a reminder that you can purchase The Darkest Hearts through greenlightbookstore.com, or if you're local to Brooklyn, in person at Greenlight from 12 to 6, Tuesday through Saturday. You can find that link to The Darkest Hearts in the chat, or you can just go to greenlightbookstore.com and search Darkest Hearts Nelson George. Thank you again, everyone, so much for spending your evening with us. And Nelson, Melissa, do you have any other last thoughts before we close things out?
Hey, thank you, Melissa, for doing, I know this is the last minute, so I really appreciate this.
Yeah, thank you as well. Thank you. So again, such an honor. Such an honor. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.